Hi, everyone. Can you hear me okay? Distance is good on the mic?
Yep.
Cool. I'm a loud person, so I never know if I'm too far or too close. So, welcome to You Can't Build a Team in the Thunderdome. I believe this is the only Lisa talk with a killer Master Blaster illustration on the title slide. So, as previously stated, I am Ryan McKern, and for those of you who don't know me, I have opinions. Today, I'm going to talk to you about the opinions that I've formed over 16 years of constantly interviewing on both sides of the table. So for 13 years, I was a sysadmin, and for the last 3 years, I've been a member of the release engineering team at Puppet. Anyone use it? Cool, that's enough hands. I don't feel terrible. If you have problems with Puppet, how we package it, how we ship it, or the rebranding, come see me at the bar afterwards, and I will do my best to help you or ignore you, depending on how generous you are with the tab. Right now, though, I am just a guy standing in front of a room of total strangers and one or two or three or four former coworkers, one current coworker, and asking all of us to objectively shed our egos for half an hour. I wanted to take a minute to set some expectations for you since we're going to spend that half hour watching me bulldoze my way through a surprisingly deep topic. First things first, I have kind of a dodgy back, so I might be moving or shifting a bunch. Not nervous, it just, you know, feels good. I'm going to mix a ton of metaphors. I mean, I am just going to really mangle them right up. The plural of anecdote is not data, but you have to start somewhere. So keep that in mind as I talk about any data sets that I've built. And I'm going to try really hard to respect your time. I appreciate you coming. So now that that's out of the way, let's talk about technical interviewing. A technical interview is where we, as an industry, wail on the frontal trivia lobes of your brain until it pops and gray matter or goo comes oozing out of your face holes. I'm just going to call them interviews for the rest of the presentation because that's less words. And since we're all admins here, that means we like automation. And that means that deep down, we're all fundamentally lazy. So what is the Thunderdome? For those of you who haven't seen the 1985 classic Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, the Thunderdome is where disputes are settled in the fictional post-apocalyptic wasteland community of Bartertown. It's a steel cage filled with weapons where two men enter, one man leave. No one ever mentions if the Thunderdome is egalitarian or not, but I choose to believe that we're more enlightened after we destroy everything. So, this is an obligatory audience participation moment. I see everyone is kind of tired. It's the end of the day. You've been to a lot of talks. You've done a lot of talking to people. Instead of a show of hands, I'm going to ask you to please stand up. Who's ever had a technical interview? Sit down if you were not asked to write code under unrealistic circumstances. Cool, most of you are still standing. All right, of all of you, who's given a technical interview before? Who has been the interviewer? Okay, that's still most of you, great. Did you yourself ask a candidate to write code under unrealistic circumstances? Not enough of you sat down and some of you waffled. Well, congratulations, those of you still standing. You're part of it. Please sit down. But that, in a nutshell, is the essence of interviewing in the Thunderdome. Our tendency is to put candidates under stress until they crack, cry, quit, or by the grace of some unnamed post-apocalyptic wasteland Bartertown deity, impress us. So here's the thing that we all know to be true, an obvious truth. Technical interviewing is usually a bad time for everyone. Interviewers frequently have a bad time. Candidates frequently have a bad time. But we keep repeating the same process, hoping that this time, unlike all other times, it will be different. Jacob Thornton was a creator and a maintainer of the Bootstrap Toolkit while he worked at Twitter. Has anyone worked with Bootstrap? It's neat. It saves you some time, right? It's a good tool with real value. He recently did some back and forth with a job networking site whose name may or may not rhyme with Pinked Bin, about how the intern screening process was more rigorous than most full-time developer roles. And he totally nailed the problem with interviewing. The way we interview candidates has become a self-perpetuating process that serves only to validate our own previous experiences in a mirrored echo chamber. And that's not my opinion. This is reinforced by a study conducted by Professor Lauren Rivera of the Kellogg School of Management. I didn't put the link in the slide because you can't click a link in a slide, but if you want to see the link, I am happy to give it to you afterwards. That's important because it's story time. I'm going to tell you three short stories about three job interviews for roles that I was never offered. There's no great lessons as to why I didn't get those jobs, but there's some really interesting takeaways about my experiences interviewing across both the country and the industry. So, in fall of 2012, I was flown in to interview at Source Control Co., a popular source code hosting platform. One of the things that Source Control Co. promised is that when you get to the airport, there will be a person waiting for you with a sign with your name on it. Validation. All any of us has ever really wanted deep down is to get off of an airplane and have a sign waiting for us with our name on it. So I get to the airport. I'm excited. I'm looking. I'm hunting. Any of my names. I have three. They'll all do. Even a misspelling. Nothing. I'm in a city I haven't been in probably 12 years. I don't know how to get anywhere. I don't know how to get anyone on the phone. I called a recruiter who said, if anything goes wrong, call me. The recruiter is back across the country where I had just come from. He's working remotely for the week. He's 3 hours ahead of me. It's midnight, and he's drunk. Not a little drunk, like really funny drunk, like college I took pictures for later drunk. But he's going to be there for the entire interview. There's no recruiter or coordinator on site at all. So he does the best he can. He calls me an Uber. A guy in a black car picks me up from the airport 45 minutes later and immediately asks me for directions to the hotel. In 2012. We work it out. We get him some directions on the GPS he doesn't know how to use, and he brings me to the airport. Drives right past the hotel down a one-way street, gets halfway down the block, and asks me to get out because he doesn't want to go around the block. This is an auspicious start to a bad time. So I get some sleep. I go out the next morning. I decide I'm going to treat myself. I pay a barber to shave me because I got to look sharp, got to cut up those edges, right? The guy looks like Edward James Olmos in Blade Runner. Do not let someone who looks like Edward James Olmos in Blade Runner shave you. He did that to himself. So now I'm lacerated before the interview. I've got to go to a drugstore. I've got to get something to stem the bleeding. And then I've got to go walk to this interview. I get to the loft where the company is, and I've been instructed, ring the bell, and someone from receiving will come get you. Okay, cool. Locked doors. I get it. We've all worked at places where you can't just walk in. That's fine. I ring the bell as the UPS guy gets off the elevator next to me, walks over, opens the door, and walks in. And then I realized just through the glass door, it's an entire company all hands meeting that I've just rang the doorbell through. No one was told to expect me. This isn't on anyone's schedule. Someone from reception comes over and just quietly says, it was open. So I get there. They let the person I'm supposed to be meeting know that I'm there. We have a great session. It feels relieving. I'm on site. I'm talking to people. I'm in my element. I'm really knocking it out of the park. But then it goes off into the wild blue yonder because there's no structure, there's no schedule, there's no plan. So they just start inviting in whoever's got a free 20 or 30 minutes to start asking me questions. Sometimes those questions are really relevant. Sometimes those questions are crazy. Somebody wanted to know how to get their gravy to reset if it breaks once they found out that I cook. Awesome. I'll tell you, you whisk in a little bit of cold water slowly while you reheat it. But that's not really relevant to what we do for a living. Very few of any of us work in kitchens anymore, I would hope. So we wrap up the interview. I'm sent home. It feels good. They tell me that it was good. A week goes by and I get an email that just says we're not moving forward. And I'm nosy, so I want to know why. And I ask for some feedback. And they hem and they haw, but finally the feedback that they offer me, the same recruiter, no longer drunk, back from the East Coast. He says to me, "You're an extremely negative person." Now, those of you in the audience who know me know that this is probably pretty true. I mean, it's not dishonest feedback. But I don't know that it's the message that you want to give to a candidate. It's not constructive. There was no offer. Also during fall of 2012, I interviewed here in Boston at a security startup that was in the Prudential Center. Does anyone in the room not know what the Prudential Center is? It's that shopping mall just down the hallway that's attached to the building that we're in, so that you can basically walk to all of the commerce you would ever need to do while you're here without actually going outside where people and weather are. But above it is like 50 floors of offices and crazy expensive condos. And below it is like 14 floors of crazy expensive parking. So the recruiter says to me, "You know, you're coming in from the suburbs, go ahead and drive. There's valet parking on site." Ooh, almost as validating as a sign at the airport with your name on it. The valet parking is $25. He's never actually used it before. He just knows that it exists. I say, "No, I'm not doing that," and I park my own car, which only costs $14. Big savings. The interview itself consists almost exclusively of micro-level trivia. My favorite example from this session is, have you ever used the tool HTOP? Does anyone know what HTOP is? Okay, but you all know what TOP is, right? It's just a third-party variation of TOP. It's an add-on. It's not part of a base distro, and it's kind of irrelevant to how we do our work. It's spit and polish, not meat and potatoes. And because it was unstructured, again, there was no plan. They couldn't tell me who I'd be meeting with, how long the sessions would be going for, or what we would be talking about, even during the interview. And the leadership of the team was incredibly checked out. This was almost 5 years ago, but when I talked to them, I said, "Where do you see the company in 5 years?" And the director, who was also the hiring manager, said, "I don't know, but I hope to see it from the beach." Reassuring, right? So finally, this is done. I'm leaving. I'm just happy to be through it. I go to the front desk and I say, "You know, how do I get my parking ticket validated? Because surely I can't be the first candidate who's ever driven in for a job interview here, right?" I was totally a pioneer. It was great. They had no idea how to handle this. No one had ever parked a car here in the history of the company. Turns out the way you handle it is you pay the parking attendant so you can leave. So this job interview cost me money. Not a lot of money. I concede that point. But it still cost me money. And the last one I want to share with you. I semi-recently interviewed with a company out west that specializes in video encoding hardware. They're moving from hardware appliances towards a hosted encoding service, and they want to scale up to meet those ambitions. So they're trying to hire up everyone they can get right now. They were recently purchased by Big Stuff Vendor, and they're in between two corporate cultures. But the interview was firmly of the style preferred by Big Stuff Vendor. It was not a good time. The interview was highly structured, but it was also extremely impersonal, with a handful of exceptions, almost entirely around the lunch that they took me out to. That was a great time. I loved those folks. I actually want to hang out with them when I go back. But the majority of the rest of the interview was producing code under unrealistic circumstances. All of the questions that they asked were ultimately irrelevant. They weren't related to the job in any meaningful way. They were questions about trivia. But this wasn't trivia night, and I didn't have hot wings. And there was no feedback offered during or after the interview. If I got something right, no one said anything. If I got something wrong, they'd make a sour face, but they wouldn't say anything. And the recruiter offered nothing on the way out the door when they called me back to tell me that they weren't moving forward. And frankly, that was a relief because I wasn't impressed with the process, because interviewing is a two-way street. Now that I've depressed you all, I want to point out that if I've learned nothing from LeVar Burton, I've learned that opinions from your peers are persuasive. So I asked the void for feedback, and 130 complete strangers shouted back at me and gave me some more data and some more stories, just like the three that I shared with you. I'm sure any number of you have stories like this yourselves. So it is a universal truth that we are kind of terrible to our candidates. If I had a little bit more time, I would run the next slide like a Family Feud board and have you all shouting out what you think is going to be on it. But I respect both your intelligence and your time. So here's some of the biggest trends I observed from the anecdotal responses that our peers provided. The rough metrics for the demographic breakdown from the people that I got responses from were an industry standard 80-20 split between respondents who identified as men or women. The average length of time that the respondents had spent in the industry fell into the 5 to 7 year bucket. And virtually no one who replied was still working for their first job. So these were all people who have had more than one interview before. And the big takeaways from this, for me, were that 20% of respondents said that we focus too much on trivia. Write a bubble sort in assembly in this web-based editor was in there more than once. 18% of respondents said that we ask too many irrelevant questions. Who here has ever been asked why manhole covers are round? Exactly. Do you design manhole covers? Do you design manholes? Have you ever been a civil engineer? 16% said there's too much antagonism. And this one's a little bit squiffy because what constitutes antagonism? Much like the judicial definition of pornography, we have to settle for I know it when I see it. And you know antagonism when you see it. The antagonist may not think that they are being an antagonist, but you know when you're being trolled. So here's some quotes from some truly awful interview experiences that people shared with me. I'm not going to read the slides at you because that's condescending and a bad time killer, but don't ever do this. This is super inappropriate. Like 10 out of 10 inappropriate, don't do. Solitary isolation is actually defined as torture under the Geneva Convention. So it's probably at least really disrespectful to candidates, even for a little while. I don't know who here's ever watched 30 Rock, but there's a wonderful Jack Donaghy quote that fits this exact set of circumstances. Never go with a hippie to a second location. This one hurt me a little bit to read because I've had this circumstance happen to me before. Valuing your time more than the candidates or treating a conversation with them like a menial task to be checked off and forgotten about sends a really strong message to candidates about not just you, but also your company. And that message is F this noise. Don't ever try to trick your candidates. It's not clever. It's unethical. Don't leave your candidates hungry if you bring them on site all day. It's unethical. Do not lie to your candidates. It is unethical. So do we do anything at all right? Kinda. Same participants as before. Same demographic breakdown as before. But this time the numbers are a little bit softer. Fewer candidates reported having good experiences at all. And this is reflected in the trends that popped up while I was analyzing their responses. But conversation, culture fit, and collaboration all scored highly with candidates. There's also some interesting corollaries to the trends from bad interviews. Specifically, relevance, prepared, and no trivia. Those were all things that people explicitly stated as part of bad interviews. And they were very quick to point out when the absence of those things led to good interviews. So what did people have to say about their good interviewing experiences? I love the description of this one. They understood me. I think that cuts at what a lot of people don't get out of an interview and why they always feel interviews are impersonal and dehumanizing. Here, the interviewer kept things moving along and didn't hesitate to offer the candidate help or talk through a problem space with them. A plus, that's great. This one reminds me a lot about the line about being understood. The candidate felt like they had an opportunity to lead with their strongest foot forward. They cared about me and my career. We should honestly try to prioritize candidate growth more than we do when we're building scorecards for job recs. We never factor in, what will you do next after this job? What will you do next as you grow through this job? We only ever seem to myopically focus on what we need right now because everything is on fire always and forever. Regardless of whether or not this interview was tailored to the candidate, they felt like it was. And that's one of the best experiences you can possibly offer someone when you're recruiting. I stole part of the quote from this one when I was writing a job rec and a description for a role on my team recently. That's how good this one was. So why do we do things this way? If we're told time after time that our interviews are bad, and we know they're bad because we grumble and groan and shrug when we are asked to interview candidates, why do we keep doing things this way? I have a broad hypothesis. There's a few things that factor into it, but it boils down to we don't actually know how to do better yet. The industry, regardless of which facet of it you work in, seems to be highly resistant to change. I believe that this is due to our work constantly being in motion. Nothing is ever finished, so nothing can ever rest. This makes it difficult to build good feedback loops. You can't really measure something that's in motion, and you can't really improve something in any meaningful way if you can't measure it. And I think that part of that is because our industry is so young. This won't be the last time you hear me talk about this, but an average human lifespan in America is currently 78 years long, according to the World Bank. By comparison, digital computing is really only about 70 years old, going from 1946 with ENIAC to 1957, which gave us Fortran, to 1972, which gave us C, in 1973, that begat Unix, 1985, we got Windows, and 2006, we got Amazon Web Services. That's one person's lifespan. One person has lived through all of that. That's not a long time. 70 years is barely long enough to call what we do a profession. We're still really more of a vocation or a trade. But I think we often overlook or forget that fact because we enjoy so many of the benefits that traditionally belong to the credentialed professions despite having none of their oversight or regulation. Our work tends to hew closely to much of the skilled knowledge work that has historically belonged to the professional classes. So calling us a profession is probably a pretty easy assumption to make. But putting on a tailored uniform with a stylish mirrored visor or helmet doesn't actually make you a world-class military strategy. And just to be clear, I'm not arguing that all of tech writ large is ready to become a credentialed profession. But all of those things together lead to this. Inertia, immaturity, and arrogance combined in our industry has led to something that psychologists call repetition compulsion. Succinctly, it's defined as repeating maladaptive behavior. And that is the best description of the standard technical interview I have ever read. So when I say traditionally credentialed professions, what am I referring to? I'm going to keep it very simple because there's a lot of them. You can't just call yourself an engineer. I don't know if you heard the capital E when I said that, but it was there. Or a doctor, or an attorney. These are often considered protected titles, and in the US, arbitrarily calling yourself an engineer, a doctor, or an attorney can usually result in criminal charges of impersonation. I know many of us have engineer as part of our job title, and that's a completely different talk that I'll give at the bar if you're interested. But I reached into my professional network and I dug up some of the professionals that I know, capital P professionals. I asked them about how they interview candidates and what they do to grow their teams. So the first person that I talked to is a friend of mine who is a big E engineer at a biomedical company. He makes tools and devices that doctors use to save lives. Some of the really important takeaways from my conversation with him are that engineers are busy. So that looks a lot like us, right? HR screens candidates pretty aggressively since they can look at your resume and see if you have the necessary education and credentials to actually do the job. That probably looks like us too, right? And their hiring process is highly idiosyncratic, varying team by team, need by need. We're three for three. But what surprised me is that they spend no time whatsoever working through engineering puzzles during the interview. They don't do weird whiteboard endurance challenges or riddles. They focus on a candidate's work history and attempt to determine if the candidate has the ability to learn new information and adapt to new needs as circumstances arise and change. So the next person I spoke with is a friend of mine who helps run a lab with a medical research, helps run a medical research lab with a nationally renowned oncology center down in New York. He's still super busy. They still have the same reliance on HR to filter out the needed credentials. So two for two there. But they rely heavily on reference letters from previous labs that you've worked with or previous heads of labs that you've worked with. Their entire industry seems to be built almost completely on top of a web of trust and reputation. It's not specifically who you know as much as who you've worked for and the work you did with them. Beyond that, they also filter heavily on your communication skills, the quality of your published work, and the quality of your data, if it's available. There's no weird, do you know how to work a centrifuge? Or what's the average lifespan of cancer cells from a cultured mouse sample if the mouse was born in New Jersey? Questions for them. They explicitly avoid micro-level trivia questions like that. Their researchers have already put in the time and effort to demonstrate that they can do the job. That's what a PhD is. And they respect the candidate's time and circumstances. And finally, I talked to a friend of mine who is a corporate attorney. He also happens to have a CS degree. He had some really great insights based on his experiences in both worlds. In corporate law, job interviews often happen while you're still in school, and the job itself is contingent upon passing the bar exam. We have circumstances like that in tech, but they're not super common. This isn't unheard of, though. For a long time, Google would poach people out of school like that. But their interview process has no weird puzzles about the standard of summary judgment or the civil litigation process. Firms assume that since you want to do this job and you went to law school and you're taking the bar exam, that you know how to do research. Not basic research, not deep Googling. There's no Stack Overflow for law, which is a lie because there's totally a Stack Overflow for law. But they're focused almost entirely on your demonstrable discretion and your ability to follow a specific process as dictated by the law. And they don't beat you around the head with strange puzzles to figure that out. While I was talking to him, he dropped this quote, which I love. I think it cuts deep, right into the heart of what's wrong with so much of how we interview. Dijkstra's algorithm, or a fast Fourier transform from memory in an editor nestled inside of a web browser, is really impressive when you want to show off, but it doesn't prove anything useful. And so many of us have asked candidates to do something suspiciously similar. Even more of us have been asked to do this ourselves, if not in a web-based editor, then on a whiteboard, probably with the expectation that that code is compilable. But human beings invented writing so we don't have to remember everything always forever. And I think we forget that a lot. So why do we care how the old world credentialed professionals interview their candidates? Why do we care about whether or not they've already found where the dragons are or mapped continents for us? They're the old world. We're the future. We are babies. We're talking about highly technical, highly specific areas of work, much like ours, that have existed for the entirety of human experience in one form or another. The idea of technology as an industry is also probably as old as human history. Point crossbows were state of the art. Siege engines were, you know, the most advanced devices ever built up until that point. Metallurgy in and of itself would be considered a high-tech art even today. But digital computing as an industry is woefully immature. We're precocious for our age, but we're immature. Our work is changing so fast that we often forget that fact. The way we interview developers and sysadmins in 2016 feels archaic. This is Margaret Hamilton in 1969. She's standing next to the Apollo guidance software created by the Software Engineering Division of the MIT Instrumentation Lab, which she led. You've seen at least one of these photos before, and that's important because Margaret Hamilton is a pioneer. her and her team had to basically invent the tools and the work that they were doing. Here's Dennis Ritchie and Ken Thompson working on a PDP-11 in 1972. Are they working on C or Unix? Maybe both. I don't know. But Dennis and Ken were also pioneers. They had to invent so many of the tools they were using because there weren't really any other options. Remember, ENIAC was only 1946. They were probably kids or coming along pretty soon then. That's not really a long time. But by the 90s, we'd gone full-on idol worship. Who can forget how Eugene the Plague Bledford saved Ellison Mineral Company's Gibson supercomputer from a group of youthful hackers back in 1995? The Plague was more of a colonial robber baron than a pioneer. But this is obviously how we computered in 1995, sitting in our server rooms, because we didn't call them data centers yet, working on grotesquely unergonomic equivalent, hacking Gibsons all day long. We don't do the computering that way anymore. Our hiring practices should reflect the more elegant, enlightened work we do. Yeah, I couldn't get through that with a straight face. I'm sorry. Our processes should at least reflect the fact that because of the war that those pioneers waged and the work that they did, we've already got about 45 years of excellent libraries, practice, and experience to draw on. Most of our work probably looks a lot like stack these components together, get work out the other end. I'm not saying we aren't doing greenfield development, but very little of our work comparatively is greenfield development. So we can probably stop reinventing every wheel just because it was too perfect. It was too round. It looked machine-made. Statistically, almost none of us have to be pioneers anymore. And we shouldn't expect every candidate to demonstrate the pioneering spirit of 1976 during the job interview or even during a phone call before the job interview. So, with all the background behind us, what did we do at Puppet to change that? The first thing we did is we listened to our candidates. I'll settle for a quick show of hands because I already made you stand up a few times. Who's familiar with Glassdoor? Cool, that's most of you. For the handful of you who didn't raise your hands, it's basically Yelp for jobs. It's a place where people who have quit can vent about the company they've left, or where candidates who didn't get a job offer can complain about the process that they hated. Lots of people who are still employed or who got job offers are on there as well, but statistically, it's mostly people who were or who didn't. We read everything someone said about interviewing at Puppet. Everything. If they said something seemed stupid, we asked ourselves why we were still doing it. And they told us that what we needed to do was communicate goals and process expectations clearly, up front, let candidates know what they're in for. They didn't see any value in trivia or puzzles. They didn't see any value in irrelevant questions. They wanted better feedback about their performance and about the role, about how they're going to fit into the role, about whether or not they're going to do well with that team or if people even liked them. And they wanted it faster. They didn't want to wait 3 or 4 weeks to hear from a recruiter. You don't want to wait 3 or 4 weeks to hear from a recruiter. But more importantly, they never, ever failed to point out antagonistic behavior. Be nice. We borrowed what works from companies we admire. That meant we needed to set very clear expectations and goals for a role before we ever wrote the job rec. We needed to know what we were looking for. It's not just enough to get a body into a seat. You have to know what you're trying to accomplish as a team and what benefit new people will be expected to bring to the team. We learned that we got better results with candidates and with interviewers if we used more collaborative screening up front. By turning the screening session into a pairing session, or even helping candidates complete the challenge if they need it, we found that we had a much better understanding of their technical strengths and weaknesses. That meant that by the time they come on site, we've already established that yes, this person can in fact fizzbuzz. More importantly, we continued that pairing through the interview. We're not doing formal pair programming, but we're working better with our candidates. Instead of asking them how to solve a problem or show us that they know how to walk a directed acyclic graph, we work with them on problems that bear some resemblance to the work the team actually does. Now, admittedly, I work in release. Part of my job is walking directed acyclic graphs. But that's not everyone's job, and not every job process should have arbitrary CS200 level questions about it. Because we do things this way, this means that if we, because we do things this way, we learn that we can actually work with these people. We're doing work together, and that's really what the job is. And we were reminded by the great hiring teams that we admire, being nice costs nothing. Be nice. I know, right? Super cute. But then we ate our own dog food. How many of you could take the interview challenges that you give candidates under the same circumstances and pass them today? No, really, show of hands. That is less than half of you. A lot more of you than that stood up and said that you interview candidates. Could you have passed those challenges when you were starting out? No hands. Could you pass them if you were not the one who designed those challenges? Seven hands. I could actually count them all. If the answer to any of those is no, you're not dog fooding. We already do it with our tools and our code. Why wouldn't we do it with our interview process? Turns out my team, at least, was very eager to do this. People love quizzes when there's no stakes and they think it's going to reveal something they didn't already know about themselves. Beyond our technical challenges, we tried to take the things that we think are important about our team culture and bring those into the interview. Don't interrupt people when they're talking. Let them finish. Don't hesitate to keep things on track if things digress. But more importantly, let the candidate talk as much as they need to. They're interviewing you too, but it's their time to shine. Let them talk. Work together with the candidates during your interview because that's how you work as a team. It lets the candidate know up front exactly what they should be expecting from your team. It lets them know what working with your team is like. And that's really important for candidates. How many of us have started jobs and been surprised by the team culture because we had no expectations set before we got there? If your team doesn't work together, please take a moment and ask yourself why, and if your team is losing out on anything because of that. And don't hesitate to let candidates take the lead during your technical sessions together. It gives them a chance to shine and demonstrate that they know something, but it also tells you a lot about them. How do they lead? Are they comfortable leading? Are they comfortable taking the reins? Are they comfortable bringing someone along with them instead of doing the work in isolation themselves? These are things we all say we want in candidates. Why not give them an opportunity to demonstrate it? And the last one is really important. If you've ever worked on a team, you know this. Be nice. Be at least as nice to the candidates as you are to your teammates. If you're not nice to your teammates, why? So how did that work out? The first iteration through, under our tuned process, we had about 30 applicants. We went through five of the pairing-based code reviews, which resulted in three on-site interviews, and two offers were made for one rec. We could not meaningfully choose between both of the candidates. So I pushed on the hiring manager, the director, the VP, and finally finance to get approval to spontaneously open a second opportunistic rec, because sometimes serendipity happens. Everybody actually went for it. They said, great, this never happens. Do it. But while I was pushing through all of those layers of bureaucracy, that candidate accepted a job for twice as much money as we were offering. That happens. One of the things that I learned talking to the attorney is that sometimes you can do everything perfect. You can do it all just right, follow all the steps, dot all the I's, cross all the T's, still lose. That's great. It's an acceptable outcome. Shrug it off, move forward. But there's a really important lesson there. Advocate for your candidates. They don't have any friends in the process. Be the candidate's friend. Push if you think it's the right thing to do. Get them in the door if you think they belong there. Our second iteration of the re-revised process, with slightly tighter criteria around the job description and slightly better turning around on the technical screening, we got about 41 applicants in 4 weeks. From those, we wound up doing 26 code reviews. We still only had three on-sites. We made one offer. but there were still 8 exceptional candidates left in the pipeline. This just boiled down to scheduling and time. You can't have everything all at once. Ideally, I could have stalled those candidates forever and interviewed all 11 of them and picked the best one and gotten the perfect unicorn with the shiniest horn. But we don't live in an ideal world, and we have to accept the reality of the circumstances around us. Good candidates are better than no one. They might not be perfect candidates, but you're not a perfect teammate. Recognize that human fallibility in the people that you want to work with. Build better things together. From a practical standpoint, what this means is that I immediately pushed 8 screened, qualified candidates directly in front of hiring managers with open rec. Instant pipeline, just add water. One of those candidates is actually going through the hiring process right now for one of those teams. That's the kind of turnaround you really want to see for candidates that you care about. If I could take a moment here to pat my team on the back, we've done a fantastic job hiring outside of the industry standards. Of those 3 offers I told you about, 2 of them are women. The team has done really good work here, and it was work worth doing, but we're not done. There's no pipeline problem if you're willing to do the work to get outside of your echo chamber. It's hard work, but it's work worth doing. Put in the time. Show up at events for marginalized groups in tech. Reach out. Engage with them. Let them know that they're welcome, and help those people past the systemic barriers that kept them out of the interview process. Get those people into seats. Let them know they're welcome on your team. So, we're near the end. If you want to make a strategic run for the bathroom, now is the time. Yeah, who am I kidding? We don't run. So this is something that Michael Gorsuch said. Michael Gorsuch is the Director of Infrastructure Engineering at Simple, an online bank based in Portland. He said this on Twitter back in February, when a lot of buzz was going around about Google's Project Aristotle, a study that they did into what makes a team healthy and how healthy, productive teams differ from unhealthy, unproductive, or even toxic teams. If anyone hasn't read the abstract from Project Aristotle, highly recommend it if you care about team building, team structure, or team dynamics at all. I know Google does a ton of really interesting technical work, but they also do a lot of really interesting sociological work around their teams, and it's fascinating. But I think that this is something worth talking about if we're ever going to talk about hiring. Teammates need to feel space to feel vulnerable, and they need to be able to feel like their teammates won't judge them for it. You should be able to afford that same space to your candidates. They're fallible, complete human beings. I mentioned that earlier. Expecting them to be machines that convert lethargy and caffeine into code is selling them short. So here's the big takeaways that I really hope you consider after we're done letting me yell at you about the things that we collectively are all guilty for. Our work is rarely this important or high stress. It never justifies antagonism or duress. Our definition of under pressure is a cakewalk for actual high pressure industries. And we shouldn't induce simulated stress just to gauge a candidate's ability to handle it. Collaboration is better than showboating 100% of the time. There's a reason that in professional sports, they have banned many of the end zone or home run celebrations that there used to be, because that diminishes team cohesiveness. It's showboating. Respect the time that your candidates have taken off from the job that they already have to talk to you about the job they may not ever get. Respect the time they spend away from their family to fly across the country and see you. Respect the time that they put into independently studying and practicing to try to impress you. There's a cost for their time, and just because we're not always paying it doesn't mean it isn't real. Respect the fact that candidates have a life outside of the job interview. Not every candidate can drop everything to fly across the country at a moment's notice just because you can only interview them on Friday. Not every candidate has a webcam for video conferencing. But that doesn't mean you can't send them one if you really want to talk to them bad enough. Hell, send them a laptop. Your company probably has a ton of spare ones floating around. Send a self-addressed return packaging slip in there with it. It'll come back to you. People do the right thing if you give them the opportunity to, mostly. Not every candidate has broadband or 40 hours to put into a take-home homework packet with 10 large problems into it, just so that they might get through the door for an on-site interview. And that's real. It happened to me once, and I still to this day cannot believe that I actually took that 40 hours to do that homework. I didn't get that job either. The candidate might become your teammate, and that's worth respect. But more importantly, they're a person, fully realized, upright, and they're here with you. Be present with them. Put away your phone or your laptop. Delegate your responsibilities for the duration of your time together. Treat them like someone you care about, even a little bit, because you do care about them maybe just a little bit, or else you wouldn't want to work with them. If you like a candidate, but they're not right for the role, you've probably got other open job recs in your company. There's probably other hiring managers. Get these candidates in front of those hiring managers. Hiring managers have very little visibility into pipelines that don't directly affect their rec. But you know good talent when you see it, and you probably know the kinds of jobs in your company pretty well. You know when someone's going to be a decent fit for that, and you owe it to the candidate or to yourself to try to make that connection whenever possible. If you've already screened them, you just shaved, I don't know, 2-3 days off of the turnaround time on getting those candidates in front of the managers. Do it. Resist repetition compulsion. Yes, I read a slide at you. It's important. Don't do all of the terrible things we've talked about just because that's how you were interviewed. That breeds stagnation, or at best an echo chamber. Always question the process. Always look to improve it, and always approach it from the position of balancing the needs of the team with the needs of the candidate. And above all, be nice. We forget this so often in the tech industry. I forget this so often in my interactions with friends and coworkers and colleagues. Cynicism is a currency in this industry. Snark is something that we dispense freely and easily for points that we can't redeem for anything. Be nice to candidates. Be nice to your teammates. Be nice to the person who cleared your abandoned sandwiches from the tables after lunch when you wandered off to another session. Be nice. And thank you for coming to both Lisa and to my talk. I'd love to hear from any of you, good or bad. Even the most hurtful feedback that you could possibly give me about this is something that I will make fun of on Twitter while I eat ice cream to soothe the wounds. All right, it's 5:34. I've gone 5 minutes over. If the organizers will let me, I'll take questions if you have them. If not, I'm here all week. Come up to me and talk about this. I care about it a lot. I care about you a lot. I care about how we work a lot. And I would love to talk to you. Okay, thank you. All right, I've got a few minutes if anyone's got any questions at all. If not, I'll give you your time back and we can all head out to the bar or the restaurant. So if you got them, line up. I see people approaching, so.
Hi, thanks.
You're welcome.
When you comparing sort of our profession to credentialed professions, if I understood correctly, it sounded like you felt that the step of having HR able to easily screen out people based on credentials was easy. Like, do you really feel that that's true, though?
It's not easy at all. It's just a little bit less time that the principal hiring staff needs to put into reading the resumes and processing them. But because we're an uncredentialed profession and each of us came through or into tech through our own path, it's much harder to standardize that.
Yeah, that's kind of what I felt.
But because we're not a credentialed profession, I also think it's unrealistic to expect the same sort of rigor from candidates that credentialed professions can. It's a two-way street.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Hi.
So there are some things you didn't address. For example, my team was hiring last year, and we got it was a very negative experience for us because we kept getting. Our HR department didn't seem to be good at screening out unqualified people. We went through a lot of phone interviews of people who only pretended to have the things they said they had in their resume. Sometimes those people managed to squeeze through, and we discovered they were fake only once they got on site. there are some things. There's a reason for all these puzzles or these technical questions, because I think it's because we're desperately afraid that we're talking to a fake, and we want to at least see some real spark and real see what they've got in their head. And sometimes we ask questions that are too hard to do, and we know that, and we tell the candidate that, but we want to see how you think about the problem. And it can be done in a nice way, or at least I hope we did it in a nice way. So, you know, I don't want to argue with you, but I'm just saying there's some other factors that you didn't cover in your discussion.
I am not advocating that we take technical screening out of the process at all. I think we absolutely have to validate that people can do the work we want them to do. I think that there are less disingenuous, less irrelevant ways to do that. But to your point about screening out the candidates, I will not lie to you. It's work. You have to be willing to put the work in. You have to talk to them. You have to work through the process with them. And it's totally a time sink that's going to pull your valuable engineers away from the process of building things for other people to use. But it's valuable work, because building a team is still building something. And it's arguably going to have a more lasting impact on your organization than any of the technical work that you do. So I think it's worth taking the time to talk to the candidates who aren't quite right. Talk to the ones who lied on their resume. Talk to the ones who are just making it up as they go along. The worst thing you can tell them is no.
No.
But occasionally you will find candidates who wouldn't have made it through a more stringent, more automated process otherwise. And I think those gems are worth the time it takes to do it. Thank you. Okay, last question. Hello.
Hi. My friend laughed at me recently because I told him how we saved time by switching from a two-phase interview process to a five-phase interview process. But what we've done is we've found more ways to kind of short-circuit it early. And one of the things we do, like, we have a first, like, sort of 15-minute interview with people just to kind of get to know them a little bit. But we also have, like, a list of some broad topic areas, and we ask them to rate themselves on a scale from, like, either 1 to 10 or 1 to 5, depending on which one remembered to do that day. And what we found is that gives us two things. Is one, it for things that they rate themselves more highly in, we can kind of go in depth and, like, oh, you say you're really good in authentication. Well, then let's dig into that a little bit more, whereas things that they say, like, oh, I'm not really so good at, we can go past that. And it also, I've found that the people who know the least are the ones who rate themselves the highest. So saying, like, oh, I'm a 10, when we say out front that means you're a published expert in that field, those are ones we've usually been able to find. And the people we've hired are the ones who've actually said a couple times, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I would rather hear that than someone try to make something up.
Yeah, that's a point that I often bring up, if time is no object. I don't know is one of the best things you can honestly hear from a candidate. It really is. It might not be the answer you're looking for, but it's the most honest answer they could ever give you. And you should be happy when they say it. To your point about a longer process letting you go faster, I love that. I often tell people you have to slow down to speed up. It's something that you learn in race car driving school. And it applies to so many things. You know, once you have a slow, reproducible process, then you can begin to accelerate the velocity because you can do it more often.
I was just, the one thing with that five phase, though, too, is we have less people from our side involved in the earlier stages. So for the 15 minutes, only one person doing it, mm-hmm. versus, you know, the full interview with, we get it.
Sure. Like you're still taking the time to talk to candidates and actually mm-hmm. figure out who they are and what they're about. And there's a lot of value in that. Thank you all for coming. Thank you all for staying. I really appreciate it. And I hope to see you through the rest of the conference.